From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and for the first time, Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for Reuters News Agency. Welcome, Arshad. And
Thank you. Here are
the issues. The Obama administration is escalating the fight against the group that calls itself the Islamic State, expanding an airfield in Syria, bombing more targets in Syria and Iraq, and increasing the role of special forces. Syrian peace talks that were due to begin January 25th in Geneva were postponed amid confusion about who would attend and what the negotiations could accomplish. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani visited Italy and France as sanctions relief opened new and potentially lucrative markets for European business. And finally, in the United States, Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump boycotted the final debate before the Iowa caucuses in a dispute with the Fox News Network. Well, gentlemen, lots to talk about. This week we're going to start overseas with ISIS, or Daesh, however you want to call it, Arshad. There have been a number of reports that the U.S. is increasing its activities, shall we say, in both Syria and Iraq. Should we get very excited about this, or is this just sort of an incremental change?
From most of the reports about this, it looks to be more incremental than sort of transformative. It's, I think, also important to look at this as very much a counter-Islamic State initiative, not a sudden dramatic escalation, for example, to use U.S. military force to end the war in Syria. Mm-hmm. It's maybe also useful to remember that in a way, this kind of started back in October when the president made the decision to deploy 50 special operations forces to Syria. Some people at the time thought, well, this is, you know, the tip of the iceberg, or suggested it might be. And to the contrary, I think most people have come to view it as part of the broader counterterrorism campaign rather than something bigger.
Tom, do you share that view? I mean, there is talk of more special forces. It's very interesting. They never call them combat troops, although in effect they really are, aren't they?
Of course they are, and they are advising their counterparts. Some of the special forces are embedded with Iraqi combat units. So it is a combat presence, but it is not an extensive combat presence, and I think there will be a few thousand more U.S. troops, whatever you want to call them, however you want to describe them. But I think what has happened, I agree with Arshad, it's incremental, but I think what a former employer of mine used to call the psychic surround has changed. And what I mean by that is it seems like President Obama does not want to go down in history as the guy who lost Iraq or lost Syria or whatever. And I think while he was elected to get out of Afghanistan, he is now willing to be more muscular in a limited way. The mindset is changing. Some of your listeners know I spent more than 20 years in and around the Pentagon as a public affairs officer in my other life, and so I have a lot of friends in the Pentagon. And I was over there in the last few days, and they all say the body language from the White House is different. For the last 7 years, we've basically been told, we don't want to hear this. Now they say, give us your ideas. Don't hold back. Tell us what we should be doing. And so that is a heartening situation. And I must say very quickly, I think part of that is Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, who is widely admired even by many conservatives who are virulent opponents of President Obama and his foreign policy. Carter seems to have built credibility with the critics and built credibility with the dissenters inside the Obama White House. And so that is seen as a positive development.
Mm-hmm. Arshad, there also have been reports, there was a piece on the Daily Beast recently that talked about some new kinds of airstrikes that are more aggressive and less concerned with killing civilians, strikes on a bank in Mosul that destroyed up to $750 million and an estimated couple of hundred pounds of gold. these kinds of strikes that they had not done before. So there is maybe a slightly different emphasis now.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to U.S. officials going back months and months now who've talked about the constraints in terms of the U.S. military's ability to launch attacks and strikes, and the enormous concern to both avoid civilian casualties. You know, one change in this that we've seen over the last couple of months was the decision to start going after oil infrastructure. Initially, there was clearly a desire to try to preserve infrastructure on the assumption that eventually you'd have Syria and Iraq, you know, that would come back and that you wanted to have the facilities there so that they could pump oil and make money. Clearly, what's one thing that's different now in targeting that infrastructure is desire to sort of starve the Islamic State of money. The other thing that Tom said that I think is well worth thinking about is the legacy question. Mm-hmm. I've talked to officials, and I've certainly seen officials quoted, who have talked about the president's acute consciousness of what he inherited when he came into the White House. And as he draws closer to leaving it, it would make sense that he'd be thinking a great deal about what he's going to leave his successor in less than a year now.
Tom, one other thing, too. It's interesting. There's a new commander of Central Command that has been named, and he led the Joint Special Operations Command previously. So there is a shift, but it's still very much based on special ops, covert support for various groups. I've read that the Saudis apparently have been funding a lot of the opposition activity in Syria. So it's a different model from what we saw under George W. Bush, certainly.
Right. It's an expansion. But on the other hand, President Obama is still very much against deploying large numbers of American combat forces. I don't think you're going to see a 10,000-troop surge, much less a 30,000-troop surge that we saw earlier in the Obama administration. That's not going to happen. He is still very reluctant to get bogged down, even though most people would say that we're pretty much bogged down at the moment. But he's willing to be more aggressive. He will be more aggressive, but it's not going to be a massive commitment. And we will see, I think, more airstrikes. We will see more special operations, more Army Delta Team, more. The acronym for the new general's command is JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command. You're going to see a lot more talk in the media about JSOC operations because there will be more of those now.
Mm-hmm. There's also the Expeditionary Targeting Force, or ETF. That was a new one for me.
I thought those were financial instruments, but
evidently not.
But there will be a more robust, a more muscular U.S. footprint, but not a big escalation of the ground footprint.
One other thing that is, I think, worth noting on this is that toward the end of last week, the White House put out a statement after a National Security Council meeting in which the president specifically directed his national security team to look harder at counterterrorism efforts in countries like Libya.
Mm-hmm.
So there is also clearly an effort underway to try to get ahead of the counter-Islamic State battle by getting places before they have made the kinds of inroads that they made 2 years ago in Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, and we should point out also that American troops are staying in Afghanistan for the foreseeable future. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Arshad Mohammed and Tom DeFrank. And we were talking about the fight against ISIS, but of course, while that is going on, there has been an effort to try to organize peace talks for Syria. Arshad, they do not seem to be making much headway.
So the difficulty here is that it has been enormously difficult for the United States and the UN to persuade the opposition to come to the talks. I've heard diplomats argue this both ways. The Obama administration, and particularly Secretary Kerry and his aides' view, is that you've got to start talking if you are ever going to hope to end what's close on a five-year civil war now. The counterargument is that if the opposition goes to talks without its basic demands having been met, that is to say, better humanitarian access, a cease to bombing by the Syrian government, that essentially they lose all credibility with their people on the ground. I mean, if their people on the ground are dying, being starved, while they're sitting in a Geneva hotel room, you know, negotiating, it undermines their credibility and therefore their ability to actually make any kind of agreement. The other thing that I've heard diplomats say in the last week or two is raise the question, is what Russia is trying to do with its intervention in Syria essentially force the United States down a path where it ends up acquiescing in Assad staying in power, even if it's a rump state of Syria? And that leaves the opposition in this very difficult position. How do they sit down and talk when their most essential demands, the departure of Assad, a stop to the bombing, and humanitarian access, aren't met? And at the end of the week, that issue has still not been resolved.
Yeah. Tom, there are a couple of different kinds of wars going on at once. I mean, Russia and Iran and Hezbollah supporting Assad, trying to take back territory in Syria to form this rump state, as Arshad put it. You have some opposition groups in various other parts of the country, and then you have the chunk that ISIS still controls. And the United States is focused on ISIS. It's not terribly focused on the rebel groups, it seems, in the middle. And it's leaving the Russians and the Iranians and Hezbollah and Assad alone to fight that fight.
Right. I mean, it's clear the United States wants Assad to go, but it's the U.S. government.
Is it?
Well, it's no longer. That's theoretically they want him to go, but they basically the U.S. government has basically put that to the side because they know it won't happen anytime soon, if ever, because the Russians are adamantly opposed to any kind of a negotiation that includes Assad having to leave. So that's what the U.S. would have to would like to see happen. But realistically, the Obama administration knows that's off the table. And, of course, that is a real red flag or red line, whatever you want to call it, with many of the opposition groups who just can't abide any kind of a political arrangement where Assad stays in power, which he's going to be able to do for a while.
Yeah, well, there is a so-called transition plan that envisions elections at some point, although very conveniently after the Obama administration leaves office. So I feel sorry for poor Stefan de Mistura, the UN special envoy for Syria, Arshad, who was reduced to pleading for the Syrian people to put pressure on the opposition to actually come to the talks.
It's worth thinking about the fact that he's also the third person who's attempted this Sisyphean task. And the other two were Lakhdar Brahimi, a very experienced and, I am told, tough-as-nails guy, and Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the UN, and both of them essentially threw up their hands and gave up. So it may be that he's been given a somewhat impossible task. The other thing that was interesting to me was, as he was talking about holding the peace talks and then ultimately postponing them, he made clear that he wasn't going to issue invitations to the talks until the big powers had kind of agreed on who should be there. And that also illustrates the difficulty of his position. If Russia and the United States can't agree, how is he going to push anybody around? So I think of Sisyphus, you know.
Yeah, well, I just wrote a piece for VOA called Mission Impossible. So very, very hard. One other factor which you didn't mention, Arshad, Tom, you might talk about, is the rift between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which has gotten only worse in the last few weeks. And, I mean, given that official Syrian opposition is based in Riyadh, I think if the Saudis told them to get on a plane and go, they would. But for the Saudis, I guess there's no percentage right now in having them join these talks, especially when the dreaded Iranians are part of them.
Nobody really trusts anybody here, anybody else, however you want to calibrate the possible coalitions. There's just a high level of distrust all the way around, and you're right, the Saudis have no use for the Iranians and vice versa, and any arrangement that includes the Iranians is going to give the Saudis even more pause than they've had throughout this this process. So to call it a mess is an understatement and being very charitable. I don't see anything happening for a while. The Washington Post had a very apt headline, a Syrian talk set to begin, but no one is sure who's coming. And much less, no one is sure what an outcome
would look
the shape
like.
Of the contours of an outcome are still very, very amorphous. So the diplomacy is going nowhere at the moment.
All right. Time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Tom DeFrank and Arshad Mohammed. We were talking about the difficulty of organizing peace talks on Syria, and one of the factors being this terrible division, Arshad, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which are backing opposite sides in pretty much all the conflicts in the Middle East right now. The president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, left his region, went to Europe, went to Italy and France, and had a rather good time of it, judging from the news reports.
So some people might view this in a way as kind of a victory lap for Rouhani, having negotiated the nuclear deal last year that was reached on July 14th, and then having secured the sanctions relief, at least the first wave of it, earlier this month. All of a sudden, it is possible for primarily non-U.S. companies to start exporting to Iran. That's a great business opportunity for non-U.S. companies, but it is also a huge political opportunity in a way for Rouhani because he can show that he has delivered something tangible. You know, the biggest thing that got announced this week was a massive Airbus order, although it's not clear to me whether that's actually finalized. The other thing I think is worth thinking about is
118 Airbus aircraft,
is what else is going on in Iran. And one thing that one has seen in the last 10 days is the disqualification of very large numbers of candidates.
Although I've seen a report that a number of them have been requalified, so.
Well, that's interesting. That's so very interesting.
We have to, you know, in Iran, everything is a negotiation.
Sure.
Right? We have to hold off there.
I defer to you on that, but I do think it's always worth trying to pay attention to what the man behind the curtain is doing.
Sure.
And in this case, there is, it would seem, a political argument underway between supporters of Rouhani, who clearly feel like they are delivering for the Iranian people, and sort of the status quo forces who perhaps wish to retain power.
Indeed. But still, if you're Peugeot or if you're Total, a number of these companies have signed deals, at least according to the news reports, Tom. $25 billion deal on Airbus aircraft. Peugeot has promised now a five-year deal worth $436 million, will produce 200,000 vehicles a year in a joint venture. Total has agreed to take between 150,000 and 200,000 barrels of Iranian oil a day. And French construction firms are going to upgrade Iranian airports and maybe build some new ones. It sounds like a pretty good haul.
I think Rouhani has done himself some good in a political sense. I mean, he certainly didn't seem to have any fear of leaving the country and being deposed. I think, but it seems at the moment that Rouhani has the support of the clerics who matter most, and I think delivering the goods, so to speak, literally and figuratively, is going to strengthen the hand of Rouhani and the moderates. Now, what that means in the next election is still a little unclear, but I think it's a positive development. And of course, the United States government is basically saying, see, we told you, if we can cut this kind of deal, it's a confidence building measure, and who knows what other positive developments will happen. The Israelis and others and hardliners in the U.S. are saying the Iranians are still developing a bomb. They're going to continue to create mischief, but we'll see.
It's worth thinking, when you think about confidence, how confident American companies, particularly aircraft manufacturers, are here. I mean, we wrote a story earlier this week that essentially sketched out the great skepticism or hesitance on the part of American airframe manufacturers, which, as you know, Barbara, have a carve-out in the deal.
Boeing has a carve-out in deal by name. Yeah.
And so what is interesting there is that we were told that their primary fear is that they don't have confidence that this is necessarily durable and mm-hmm. that there could be snapback, meaning that the sanctions could be slapped back on. And what happens to them if they've entered into contractual obligations to sell X, Y, and Z airplanes, and then all of a sudden the ground gets cut out from under them. And it's worth thinking perhaps here about the Republican debate, where you saw Marco Rubio say that on his first day as president, he would rescind the deal. Whether or not you think that's going to happen, if you're a business person, that makes you think twice.
Yeah, well, he stole that line, didn't he, from Ted Cruz, who had promised to tear it up on his first day. So I guess maybe we'll segue back to the United States since Arshad has raised the debate. Tom, there was a final debate before the Iowa caucuses, before actual Americans actually vote. And Donald Trump decided he would take his toys and go play by himself.
Yes, he decided to opt out of this debate sponsored by Fox News because the moderator, one of the moderators, Megyn Kelly, is someone Mr. Trump has decided is unfair and treats him badly. And he called her a lightweight the other day. And so he just declined, basically, as he said several times, to deprive Fox News of ratings, which is probably going to cost them a few $1 million in revenues without Trump. We have known that Donald Trump is a billionaire and a blowhard and a bully, but it turns out he may be smarter than the rest of us. But we've been saying, all of us from these microphones have been saying for a long time, any other politician who has said and done some of the crazy things, some of the outrageous things that he has done and said would have been gone a long time ago. Not only is Trump not gone, at the moment at least, he's ahead in Iowa and well ahead in New Hampshire, the first two events in this primary season. And so I do think the debate was a little duller without Mr. Trump, but it still was still had a little snap, crackle, and pop, particularly with Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Marco Rubio sparring with each other from beginning to end. I think this is going to boil down to an establishment candidate who Rubio hopes will be himself, and either a Trump or a Cruz. And so everybody was negotiating for position.
Yeah, Arshad, one of the things that people point out is that a lot of people attend these Trump rallies because they're good entertainment, but there are real questions about how many of these people will actually come out and take the 2 or 3 or 4 hours required to caucus in Iowa. But I think that the idea that with Trump out of the room, everybody else, of course, was in a circular firing squad attacking each other. Certainly Ted Cruz came out rather battered, I thought, from this debate, mostly because of a fight with his fellow Cuban first-generation American Marco Rubio.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting that at one point during the debate, he essentially suggested that the moderators were basically asking people to attack him.
he took the Trump role in a way.
May I ask a question of Tom?
If
you were to bet, Tom, would you bet that Trump hurt himself at all by staying away?
We'll know very soon, but I don't think he hurt himself. He's been behind in Iowa for a long time, and in the last 10 days or so, he has surged ahead. So if he loses narrowly, you might be able to attribute it to the no-show on the debate, but I don't think so. If Trump comes in second in Iowa, I think it'll be because, as Barbara said, he is poorly organized on the ground. A lot of Trump support are not first-time voters, but they're people who don't do the very cumbersome caucus situation. As you say, it takes hours, and it's not the kind of thing that Trump supporters would normally gravitate to. So if Trump comes in second, I think the conventional wisdom will be that he didn't have a ground game until too late in the game. But we'll know very soon. It's going to be very interesting at these microphones next week.
Meanwhile, the rest of the world is watching with horror. this spectacle. But that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for Reuters. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Limus Rinkus. I'm Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.